Okay, we're on page 57. Let's talk about being a slave. Avdus. We know that the time of Pesach is Zman Cheresenu, a time of freedom. You only go free if you're a slave. The Jewish people were slaves. Mitzrayim was a makom of Avdus. It was a physical location where the Jewish people were trapped. It was the North Korea of its day. I don't know how better to put it than that. However, Mitzrayim is not only a place, it's also a state of mind. Mitzrayim represents a spiritual slavery as well as a physical slavery. Let's have a look at some of the Jewish sources that discuss that, because if it was just a physical slavery, then all we'd be doing is just kind of remembering how bad it was for our ancestors, and that's it, Salavi. However, that is not the reality. Mitzrayim is an ongoing battle. It's an ongoing state that exists upon all of us. Let's start with a little bit of Rabbi Dessler, because he talks about this on page 57. He says like this, Hine kol inyan v'chol davar yesho tochen pinimi. Everything in this world has an inner aspect to it. It's not just the outer aspect, the shell. There's always going to be something inside which is going to reveal something to us. Inyan ha-galut, this exile of Egypt, nira la-adam ha-chitzoni be'ikar galus ha-guf. It would appear to a person as if it were just a physical slavery, just an external reality. They held us in chains and wouldn't let us out. Aval ha-adam ruchni, however, a spiritual person who's wearing glasses that reveal something deeper, ha-panimi, of internality, roe can see shagalut hagufnit, this physical slavery that we the Jewish people endured in Egypt for those 210 years, hirak hamasovev, this was just a outside relating thing, but the real thing, reb gos benefesh, was actually slavery of the soul. That's what we were involved in, slavery of the soul. What that means, we're going to have to see. Pirush, hayeta tachat mamshel yitzhara. There was a yitzhara that was over us. That, says Rav Dessler, is going to be a lot more challenging than just a physical slavery. Hashem Mitzrayim, he says, this word of Mitzrayim, nigzar mashorish meitzar, we mentioned this before, comes from the root word meitzar, which is a narrow confine, dochuk. As we say, we called out from the narrow confines. We were constricted in a state of distress, v'gam gvul, and also a boundary. Who was the king of Egypt? Was Paro. What's Paro? So Paro is related to another word, which is parua. Parua. Parua is to lay open, to untie, unbridled. Everything's open. Do whatever you want. Hare shebchinat hanhaga hatuma, because it was the spiritual impurity that existed inside Egypt, Shemisraim. He petichat hagvul yetzeh sheyachol lekanes letashpashet kavratzon. It was actually that opened up the Yetzara. Paro was Parua. Everything was okay. It was all untied. And everything we had to deal with was on a spiritual as well as a physical nature. Turn over the page. There are other commentaries, but... And we're going to talk about this in a little bit more detail. So, according to what we just said, slavery doesn't just mean being stuck in Egypt, which means that at any given opportunity, any given time, we the Jewish people are potentially slaves wherever we are. It's no longer just a person, as we said, it's a state of mind. Based upon this, we're going to see a few commentators. One of them I'm going to do inside, the others we'll do outside, which discuss this idea. And from the Haggadah, we see the following words. Bechol dor v'dor, in each and every generation, chayav adam, a person is obligated, lirot et atzmo, to see themselves ki'ilu hu yatza Mitzrayim, as though they left Egypt. Okay? That is how a person sees themselves. Every year, at this time, when they get to the Pesach Seder, says, this is Haggadah speaking, a person should see themselves as though they left Egypt. That's very strange. I've never been to Egypt. I have no desire to go there. Why would I have to see myself as though I left Egypt? Why does it become a personal thing? Okay? It's based upon a pasuk in the Torah, where it says, we have to be grateful because Ba'avor Zeh Asali, what Hashem did for me when He took me out of Egypt. The Torah speaks of the Exodus in the first person. It doesn't say what happened to them, what happened to us, to me. Right? The locative Lanu, Ki'ilu Yatza, it's written as though I was in Egypt and I left. So everyone writes and reads, rather, the Haggadah, as though they left Egypt on a personal level. How can this be? What is this idea? I'll take some answers. Based on what we just said, that alone should give you a good clue. Why would the Torah expect us, and the Haggadah backs it up, and says that we have to see ourselves as though we left Egypt? Yes.
Does that mean we're like in a constant like work of our soul?
There's a constant struggle that we have. We are constantly slaves to the Yetzer Hara, based upon Rav Dassler is saying. And therefore we are constantly dealing with trying to battle and overcome that Yetzer Hara. That is a battle that does not go away, it does not disappear.
So what does it mean? So like in Pesach, does it mean being free from it? Because
so, very, very good, exactly. So Pesach has the ability to free us from those constraints. Happens to be 3,326 years ago, our ancestors were also trapped on a physical, spiritual level. They managed to tap into that energy of that time and able to get out. But that same opportunity is open to each and every one of us every year. So Pesach is no longer an event, it's a time. And it's an idea. Pesach is no longer an event, it's a time and it's an idea that's available to us every single year. That's what we're saying over here.
So
exactly.
It's to win the battle, or if it's constant battle, it's just to like.
Just to win that particular.
Just a little thing that's overall.
Right. Right. There's a battle and there's war. We have to keep fighting. It does not stop. It's a constant struggle. And Hashem put into the calendar one day which gives us a better chance of winning it over. That's why it's Zman Cheretenu, the time of our freedom. Bayam Mahem, in those days, Bazman Hazeh, but at this time. This is the time for it. Oh, are you saying you can't go free whenever you want? And the answer is, of course you can. However, sometimes are more musugal. They are more fitting for it. I want to just point something out, actually, how the Rambam understands this a little differently, this one pasuk. We see that it says, "B'chol tov ador chayv adam lirot et atzmo." The Rambam, Maimonides, says something a little. When he brings out this halacha in Hilchos Matzah, in the laws of Pesach, he changes the word lirot. He changes the word lirot to read something else. He changes it to read Laharot. What's the difference between Lirot and Laharot? Liros and Laharos. Yes, Bella.
Lirot is to actually see, and Laharot is to show something.
Very good. Lirot is to see. To see. This is the Rambam outside I'm doing this. I did not bring the Rambam down. Maybe I think later on in the book I brought it down. Just but while we're looking at the word itself, Lirot is to see. Laharot is to show, to be seen. Harot is the causative, right? Harot is to be seen, it's reflexive. Right? So what's the difference between Lira? Why would he change it to Laharot? So he reads this very, very differently and says, "Hold up, Chayav Adam Laharot atzmo kilu es hametz Yisrael." A person has to show themselves as though they left Egypt. What does that mean? A person should demonstrate the idea of freedom. How do we do that? How do we demonstrate that we're going free? What do we do? What are we going to do to demonstrate, to show that we were slaves and now we're free? Well, there's a bunch of things we do. Some of them are actual mitzvahs of the day, and some are minhagim. One of the mitzvahs of the day, for example, is to lean. Right? We lean. Why do we lean? Like free people. We eat matzah. We lean like this. Right? We eat matzah. Yeah? Just like the Jews who ate matzah when they left Mitzrayim. We drink wine. Slaves don't drink wine. They're too busy working.
I thought matzah was poor man's bread.
So the beginning, it starts as poor person's bread. That's what they were fed when they were slaves. And then by the end, it represents freedom as well.
Okay.
We're going to come to that. We're going to spend a good class on matzah, but it changes. It starts as lechem oni, and then eventually becomes the food of freedom, and we keep re-eating it every single year to represent the freedom aspect of it. You're right. That's different parts of the Seder. But you are correct. But it does eventually represent the idea of freedom. Where we eat it is as free people. Okay, we'll see why matzah has a representation. It's the lack of chametz in it. Right? Chametz represents the Yetzara. Why? We're going to come to that. Yes, Lee?
Okay. If you ask me which holiday out of all the holidays, the most constraining would be Pesach. And
the what? The most what?
Constraining. Like
constraining.
Because we have... Is that a word? Yeah.
Okay, fair.
It's like we have so much that we have to do rather than... Like, where is the aspect of freedom in this whole situation?
Okay.
All we do is...
So freedom, very, very good. You're mistaking freedom from the... I'm explaining.
Well, not physical, but even
well,
spiritual.
All freedom. All freedom isn't just sitting back doing nothing. Freedom, we're going to see, doesn't mean free to do nothing. It's free to do something. Freedom involves work and effort. And, what's the key word? Responsibility. That's really what freedom is. Freedom doesn't mean free to do whatever I want. Freedom is I have now a new responsibility. The Jewish people went free, but they also got the Torah 49 days later. They weren't free. Well, okay, let's go. Let's do whatever we want. You know, that's not what happened. So don't mistake the idea of freedom as I can either do nothing. That's what freedom is. I have no constraints on me, no mates out. Now I can fulfill what I'm meant to do in my life. So just because it's hard work, it's work. It's a voda. Preparing for Pesach takes a lot of time, effort, and money, right? We're not saying, oh, that's freedom. Freedom is we have to work, we have to earn it. It takes effort. It takes avdut, right? Actually, we just changed owners. We went from Paro to Hashem. Right? We just moved over. Just a change of boss. We became Avadim to Kodesh Baruch Hu right afterwards. That takes responsibility. Okay? So that's the Ram. Now, people do other things. It's not just halachot. It's also various minhagim. Various people do various things to demonstrate, to show. Right? We read the Haggadah. Right? But we also do, which is a Torah obligation we're going to see. But we also, every community has their own customs, their own minhagim, which represent the idea of freedom. You know, Moroccans do this way, and Persians do that. Different communities do different things, and act out various things, and move the matzah up and down, and open and close. All these things are there, leharot, to show that we are now free. That's the understanding of the Rambam. Okay? So the Maral is taking a different track, and the Maral is saying, that's all well and good, that's all true. However, the idea is that each time we get to that point of year, we have the potential to go free, which means I'm still a slave, right? That's what it must be. Rashi says something interesting. Rashi says that this idea of seeing ourselves as we left Egypt every year is really a hakara. It's a recognition. It's a recognition. That's Rashi. Rashi says this idea of every year, b'chol dor v'dor, is actually a recognition. What's the recognition? That if we had not left Egypt at that time, we would still be there. So it's as though we leave every year. Because had our ancestors not left, then we'd still be there. Right? And we wouldn't have reached Har Sinai, and we wouldn't have come to the Jewish people. And that's the end of it. There wouldn't have been a Jewish People, Inc. So Rashi's whole point is you should see yourself because had they not left, you would still be there as an individual. It's a very personal thing. That's Rashi's understanding of this piece.
Why is it not taken so literally that if we don't commemorate Pesach, if somebody doesn't progress this off in this way, that they're like spiritually enslaved all year. Like, we have some other opportunities for Teshuva, if this is what it represents as a time to free ourselves from that.
I'm missing your question.
Like, if we're commemorating the release of from slavery, if we're commemorating the leaving,
yeah.
But it's also, you know, leaving,
yes,
spiritual slavery.
Yes.
Then I guess, like, why don't we treat this as the opportunity, like, I mean,
the opportunity to,
to, like, if somebody for some reason misses this, misses being able to commemorate this, not being spiritually enslaved all year until,
yeah,
it until this time comes,
yes,
again.
Yes.
Why, when we have so many other opportunities for teshuva, why,
yes,
are they elevated the same way?
This isn't so much a teshuva thing. We're not doing teshuva. They're not doing tshuva. And by the way, that's the exact point. It's not a commemoration. Is it happened in the past and I commemorate it. It's not just that. I am commemorating that event. But it's much, much more than that. I'm reliving it. It's happening again. That time is coming. I'm in the same place. I'm literally in the same, with the same opportunity to get out. I'm not stuck in Egypt. That wasn't for a few and a half thousand years. But that's not the point. I am still in a place called Mitzrayim. That's my confine, and by going through the mitzvah, the cleaning of the chametz, and the removing it from your home, and preparing for the Seder, and then the Seder itself, doing all the mitzvot, I go free. Somehow, in some way, freedom, I become free from that experience. I'm just reliving, I'm just like waving a flag to remember what happened. It's happening again. It's a constant thing. It's just once a year, the door opens, and I can walk through at a much easier way. So it's more than a commemoration. And I'll tell you something even wilder than that. I'll give you one interpretation. We did Rashi, we did the Rambam. I want to give you a more modern commentator who gives a wild, mind-bending understanding of this. And he says, this is Rav Shimon Schwab, who lived in the Heights, and he wrote about this, and he says that actually, you go free. It is you, because you left Egypt. But it's like, I was never in Egypt. He goes, that's your misunderstanding of what the Jewish people are. That's what he says. What does that mean?
He says, yes.
He says, you were in Egypt. You were in Egypt, and you got out. When it says, a person sees it as though they left Egypt, that's because they were in Egypt. He said the Torah wouldn't expect it. He wouldn't say in the first person if they'd actually been there. So he said, but I've never been there. He says, you were there, you just don't remember. And then he gives a very fascinating analogy for this, which is just a completely brilliant way of understanding the Jewish people. You see, we see the Jewish people as people who lived thousands of years ago, and the people who lived 1,000 years ago, people who lived 400 years ago, and then there's us. So we're just one, you know, link in a chain. He says, no. And he gives a metaphor, which I love this, by the way. If I were to show you, well, he does a little slightly different metaphor, but let me just, if I were to show you a photo of yourself, Minky, as a 2-day-old baby, would you recognize yourself? No. Right? 2 days old, you were a small, shrinking little creature, right? You recognize it. How'd you know it's you?
Someone told you.
But it was you. Doesn't look like you. If we had video, it would really sound like you, right? You don't remember being a 2-day-old baby, but that's still you. He says the same with the Jewish people. We had a birth. We were born when we left Mitzrayim. We went through the desert. And in the Midbar, we had the man, which they call the lavan, the white stuff, like milk from a mother. And then over the years, we have progressed and grown up. We don't remember that. In other words, the Jewish people aren't past, present, future. We're one large, organic whole that has passed through history. That's the way to look at it, he says. So you were there, which me, the young me. I could look at the DNA of that two-day-old baby Minky, and I could maybe figure out somehow that was actually you. You could do the same with those people thousands of years ago as well. The trace of us is there. So although I don't actually see myself, and I don't remember it, I don't remember past my childhood anyway. It still happened to me. He says you have to change the way you look at the Jewish people. We are one large, holistic, organic whole that has passed through. And he brings a very interesting proof for this. We know the Jewish people, when they entered into Egypt, were called Shivim Nefesh. When the Jewish people went into Egypt, they were called 70 soul Nefesh. Nefesh is the singular. Esav and his family were called 70, they were called, no, well, 70 of them, Nefashot, the plural. 70 people shouldn't be Nefesh, it should be Nefashot. So he says Nefesh means we're one united soul. We're one united reality. And he brings that on this verse. And he says, that's why a person seems as though they left Egypt, because you were there. I don't remember it. That's not the point. I can still tell you stories about your childhood without you remembering it. And that's what we do. We'll tell you, we're hearing stories, the word Haggadah, Lahagid, to tell over, Lesaper, to speak it out, right? Pesach, pair the mouth. Sach speaks. You speak it out because you're hearing what happened to you as an early nation, which is you. That's what he says. So he moves away, Chava, from the complete idea of commemoration. You're not commemorating, you're just remembering. Which probably explains why the Torah used the expression Zecher Litziat Mitzrayim. In other words, Zecher means to remember, but it means an act that we do certain things to remember. Okay, so that's where the Zecher we're going to see is a code word for doing actions. But that's his understanding of it.
What's his name again?
Rabbi Schwab. Rabbi Schwab was his name. This is very typical of his very novel way of looking at the Jewish people. It was from Germany. Okay. New topic, page 57. Sorry, 59. I apologize. One of the key features of the Pesach experience is miracles. Miracles are a major part of the Pesach experience. Now, the miracles of Pesach are very, very different to the miracles of Purim. Purim is considered miraculous. Pesach is considered miraculous. But they are different. What are the expressions we use to demonstrate this difference? Purim is, what kind of nes? Nes, nistar, nistar, nes, which is hidden miracle. Nistar, Esther, hidden, right? But Pesach is a different type of miracle, which is nes, right, nigla. Nes nigla, which is revealed, revealed miracles, open miracles, that which change. Which change, and unlike the Megillah that describes the events of Purim, where we see Hashem's name is not mentioned even once, when it comes to the Haggadah, Hashem's name is replete within the story, and Moshe Rabbeinu's name is mentioned once in the entire Haggadah. It's all about God. Moshe Rabbeinu, mentioned once, and even there is called like Eved Hashem, the servant of God. Okay? It's a very different focus, a very different idea, because this is the birth of our nation. And the birth of the nation of the Jewish people was a miraculous, one-off event of a nation born from the crucible of Egypt, as we referred to two classes ago, into a whole different reality. Let's have a look at some verses to discuss this. And then we'll talk about the miracles. So let's look at some Pesukim. Okay, page 59. It says in Vayikra, Chaf Gimel, 23, Vav through Chet, 6 to 8. Uvachamisha asar yom lachodesh hazeh chag hamatzot l'Hashem. On the 15th day of this month, the month of Nisan, is going to be the festival of matzot. Why the holiday is named after the food that we eat on it has to be discussed. Why matzot are such a integral, Torah-mandated part of the holiday, we're going to have to try to figure out. Why would this flat cracker bread represent everything that the Exodus is all about? Okay, that's one question we have to figure out. Shivat yamim matzot echlu. For 7 days you shall eat matzot. B'yom harishon, the first day, Mikra Kodesh, is called a holy day. Okay? That's a day the Torah is mandating. When you see those words, you know you cannot do malacha. Okay? On Purim, you can do malacha, because it's not a Torah holiday, and the rabbis cannot mandate the idea of no malacha. However, the first day of Pesach is, okay, and Chos Taharos, first and second day. Right? But on a Torah level, the first day is the main day. Yelachem, kol malacha tavada, lo tasu, don't do malacha. We know what malacha refers to. What should we do? V'kraftem ishe l'Hashem. You have to bring a sacrifice to Hashem. Shevet for 7 days. B'yom ha'shvi. Mikra Kodesh. Kol malacha. Avada lo tasu. So the first day and the seventh day are the days of no malacha. And we're going to see there are intermediate days, which are weekday yet holiday. Chol yet moed. Okay. These are days of rejoicing, of happiness. These are happy days. That's what we're looking at. Let's start with the main part, which is going to be the Makos, the 10 plagues that befell the Mitzrayim. Okay? There were 10 plagues that we went through. We already spoke in the past about how we ended up in Egypt. Now we're going to talk about how we got out after 210 years. The Maharal says that these plagues that came upon, the miraculous nature, which is really the main part, right? The plague is going to have a major part of the Pesach Seder, the Haggadah, the story, the Torah. Let's have a look inside. He says, Tamid, Hamakashim Malamali Yoter Kasher. Basically, the pattern was that each subsequent plague was worse than the one before. It started light, and then it got worse, and then worse, and then worse. Right, it wouldn't follow by a lighter one. Therefore, the plagues ascended in severity from low to high. Okay. By the way, since we're discussing miracles, let's look at the word. You know, I'm a big fan of knowing words, because words aren't just labels. They are descriptive of what's happening. A nace in Hebrew, I think we discussed this before, right? We discussed Purim. A nace is, we said, a miracle, but it's also a banner, a flag. Remember we said that? Why would a miracle be the same word as a flag or a banner? Because once a miracle has happened, that becomes conquered territory, right? It's as though a person's there. You put a flag down when you show that I've been here. So it's Hashem's way of putting a flag down, as it were, and saying, this is the event that happened in this place. Okay? Or, at this time. So, we know how it worked. Moshe Rabbeinu went to Paro and wanted to let the Jewish people, go. Kama Hashem. Bezos teida, this should be known. Ki ani Hashem, v'ini anochi makeh b'mateh. I'm going to hit. Hashem b'yadil amayim, Hashem b'yor, v'nefu l'dam. The first plague was hitting the Nile, so that it became blood. By the way, who actually did that plague? Very, very good. Why? Why couldn't Moshe Rabbeinu do it? Right. That's weird. Isn't that strange? Why would... One second. Let's just think about this for a second. Why would Moshe Rabbeinu, knowing how to hit the Nile, or to bring out the frogs, or to bring out the kinim, the lice, from the dirt? Because remember, the dirt saved him when it swallowed up that Mitzri. Yeah. But it didn't feed him.
But it saved him even more.
But it's a inanimate object.
Yeah. I mean, if you're saying that everything is, You're saying everything, every word has a description of something. How
yeah.
do you say it's an inanimate object because obviously there's some purpose to it, like saving Moshe's life?
So why should you, very, very good. So I can understand the essence to it, but why should Moshe Rabbeinu make sure he doesn't harm it? So I want
to
say like this. I think you're right, but let's go a little bit deeper. I think the idea is that we, and by the way, this also applies to us. I want you to think of a time, there is one famous occasion where we take on care for an inanimate object. An inanimate object where we give it extra...
When God uses it to help us.
Us. Right now, halacha today, there's halacha, well not specifically today, but there is a time where we care about...
Tree.
That's showing respect. That's showing, I'm not saying respect to holy items or trees. The Torah says you have to respect trees. Although, you know, you're right. You can say trees as well, specifically. There's actually halacha that you're not allowed to cut down fruit trees. You're in the midst of war, says the Torah. And you want to make a battering ram or use wood for something. You're not allowed to cut down a fruit tree. To this very day, you can't cut down fruit trees. Okay? That's a little similar.
Do you cover the challah?
Oh, very good. Covering the challah. Well done. Why do we cover the challah? Because you don't embarrass the challah. Have you ever seen challah go red from embarrassment? I've seen it go brown from being in the oven. You ever see it go red from embarrassment? It's interesting, right? But we have the halacha today. We cover the challah. Why? Because actually, men made the brach on the challah before the ayin. But you have to make kaddish yom. You have to make kiddush. You make kiddush first on the wine so that you cover the challah. I'm embarrassed. Okay? Bread comes embarrassed. It's not that inanimate objects feel anything or know what's going on. Bread is not embarrassed, and the Nile would not have taken offense. It's that we, if we show Hakaras HaTov to inanimate objects, how much more so will we start to take care of people? Okay, that's the lesson that's meant to be learnt. Okay, there's no coincidence, I believe, that particular halacha applies on Friday night, on Shabbos, which is the time of Hakaras HaTov, you know? It's time of connected to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. Right? I believe there's no coincidence that that's how we begin our Shabbat, by caring for inanimate objects, how much more so people. Okay? And I always thought, so why would this lesson of Hakaras HaTov to inanimate objects appear here in the Torah, in this story? It could appear in any story. So I think, this is my personal take on it, you can take this part or leave it, but I think I want to say that slaves are rarely grateful. They're too busy surviving. A sign of a free people is they're able to show gratitude. Right? You're not able to be... You're not... Slaves, who's got time? Like, you're too busy just trying to survive. A sign of freedom is the ability to say, thank you, I appreciate what you did for me. That's an advanced thing. Being able to be grateful. Animals just take... There's no... But humans have the ability to say thank you. And give and recognize that there's a source of my blessing. Maybe that's why. So over here, we become free for the first time. So maybe that's why at this point, this idea started to come out that the people knew. Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't just for Moshe Rabbeinu. This was a lesson for the Jewish people at that time and for us as well. That's how freedom is, the ability to show Hakaras HaTov, gratitude. And that's really what this whole story is about, really, isn't it? We have Hakaras HaTov, we have gratitude to God that we got out of Egypt. Right? Okay, so we're going to divide up the plagues. So you have something to say, Hava, yes?
Going back to what you said, what Mara said about how each plague increased in
yeah.
severity.
Yes.
So why would the first plague have to do with the water? The Egyptians worshipped the water as a god.
Each plague was difficult. It just means how it affected them. How it affected them was much more severe. On a physical level, they were able to buy water, and then it got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, until it got to the death of the firstborn. It's partly, all their gods were broken down eventually, all their beliefs. Yeah. Yep. They did worship the Nile. So we're going to divide up the Makos, according to the Malbim's understanding, into three groups of three, then one group of one. Okay, you can see this on page 61. Three groups of three, than one group of one. Let's just have, you know, let's do it by the chart, because that's easier to see. Look at the chart on page 61, yeah? So let's have a look. Just by looking at the plays, can you tell the difference between the first three, the second three, and the third three? Just look at them to the left, if you don't mind, and see if you can see how the first three could be connected, the second three could be connected, the third three, and why the last one's all by himself. So if Damsavadeh Kinim, Oirev Devashchin, Barad Arbe Choshech, and then Makas Bakoros. What do you think? Well, where did the first three happen? Water or from the earth? Right, the lights came out of the earth. Where did the second three happen? On the earth. And the last three happened from the air, right? The hail came from the air, the locusts came from the top, the darkness come from down. And then the death of the firstborn actually was equal to all the nine previous to it. So let's have a look. Yeah, Chava?
I was just going to add that they're also put into the groups of three categories because they follow the warning, no warning. But anyway, I was just...
So that's going to be part of it.
The chart, yeah.
We're going to come to the warning part.
How did the last one come?
We're going to talk about that. That's its own one. That's going to be the once HaKadosh Baruch Hu showed, he showed he has control over life and earth, a life and death rather. The first three are from below, the second three are from the land, and the third three from above. This was a university course. This was a college course in God's control of the earth, whatever you want to call it. Okay, so what's the attributes? The first nine plagues is the Malbim, the first set of three demonstrate the existence of God in response to Pharaoh's denial. There is no God. Okay, they come from below. That's the physical location. Being a lesser form of plague, they were formed by Aaron. So Aaron took on the first three. Then we'll see the lesser three. Okay, it showed God's control over the water. That's the dam. Aquatic creatures. That's the Sephardea. And the lice. That's the dust on the earth. So that's Hashem's control of those three elements. And there was no warning. However, there was a warning by the third one. And there was no warning about the third. The first two had a 1 week of 3 weeks of warning, 1 week of plague. Is that right? Yeah. Is that right? Okay. But there was no threat to life with it. That's the first three. Then we enter onto the land. And we have Orev, we have wild animals. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's control, Hashgacha, over all the world's details. Okay. Because Paro claimed that God exists, he has no authority over the world. So the second set are land animals, then the life of land animals, and then boils came on the humans. Once again, warning, warning, no warning. The last set of three was the Bara, the Arab, and the Choshech. And that showed God's power is absolute in response to Pharaoh's claim that if God does have powers, he has other gods that equal. Such as, I'm control of the heavens as well. And that's nature, hail, flying creatures with the locusts, and Choshech is day and night. And finally was Makat Bochorot, which is life and death, which is the ultimate control. Right? And that came with a warning. And that was the one that pulled it all together. And that was the final one. So that's one way we do it. And actually, if you look in the Haggadah, we actually say Tzach, Adash, Bach. And Makas Bachoros, okay? Those were put out. They were actually separated out in that way, right? In the Haggadah and on the Moshe Rabbeinu's matah, on his staff, was etched into it in that way. Bachav. Okay?
Wait, what's Haggadah? I know it's academic, but...
They died. The animals died. Rashi brings down a chumash. Those I'm sure you've studied this before. Actually says that this is the way humans go to war. Right. First of all, when armies battle against each other, first of all they infect the water supply. Right. Because once you have no water, they're in big trouble. Then they make loud noises before they charge. Make a lot of rush, a lot of noise. That was the croaking of the frogs. Then they shoot arrows, right? I think it says like kinim, lice that went into the bodies. And then they attack and they charge. And he brings on the rest of the Mechilta, is brought down, of how each one of them, then they finally, they get the generals, attack the top leaders and put them into jail, which is darkness, and they kill them. Right. So this is actually, Kadosh Baruch Hu gave it to them in a way that they understood. We know also the first five plagues were different from the second five as well. There was a difference when it came to Paro's acceptance of them. Oh, so it says that Paro hardened his heart, and then we know that eventually Hashem had to harden Paro's heart for the second five. Sound familiar? Why would that be? Why would that be? And how can Paro be held responsible if his free will had been removed? Right? They removed his free will. Hashem hardened his heart, which means maybe he would have let them go. Are we removing Paro's free will by hardening his heart? So the first five, he hardened his own heart, i.e. he was stubborn, let them go. After that, he probably would have let them go. Once he hit plague 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, he probably would have let them go, but Hashem didn't even let him. Hashem hardened his heart. It's not fair. Isn't that the removal of his free will? Yeah.
Because any normal person with a normal heart in these plagues wouldn't even have free will because they were so scary that they would have to say no. So by hardening his heart, he was actually giving him
free. Right. In other words, his free will decision was not let them go. Since the plagues were so difficult, very good. Since it was difficult, he would let them go. But that's not his will. His will was to not let them go. So Kadosh Baruch Hu wasn't removing his free will. He was actually giving his back his free will. He was returning his free will to him. Very good. He was returning his free will to him. By the way, I just want to point out that there are some commentators that say the frogs, Safadea, weren't actual frogs, but say, I think the Sforno says this, if I remember correctly, they were alligators or crocodiles. It changes the whole place. Something completely different, doesn't it, when you see that? Right, there was some biting creature. Suddenly having a frog in your bedroom or a crocodile in your bedroom changes things greatly. When you look at it that way. Yeah? Now within these miracles were other miracles as well. Inside each miracle were other miracles as well. Okay. Let's have a look on page 62. So Chazal say that this swarm of animals actually, there were many, but also when we go through the Yam Suf as well, there wasn't one miracle, there were maybe 50 miracles that happened to the Jewish people, according to Chazal, when they went through the Red Sea as well. So this was miracles within miracles. Okay? So actually, when it came to the Arav, the swarm of wild animals, they're referred to as a swarm. Right? Why do they call it swarm? There were, you know... So Chazal say like this. These were different species of animal from all over the world. And some of them can only live in very cold climates. Others can live in hot climate, like the snakes. However, during this plague, all the species were able to coexist. This was also a phenomena, an unnatural phenomena within it. Right? The Barad as well. The Barad came as ice. But within it, they say, was fire, some kind of fire or... some mixture of fire was added into this miracle. So it's as though the entire world, animal and creation, was coming together at this point. Okay? So it was much worse than before. Eventually, Paro lets them go. But then something really interesting happens. They were told to do something very interesting. They were told to take a sheep, is after the plagues, and to bring the sheep into their home and tie it to their bedpost. And by the way, that's because that's what they used to have, right? If you look at old houses, all they had was like a bed. You know what I'm saying? So to tie it up in their house. This is 4 days before they left. Why? Why were they told to do this on the 10th of Nisan? Why were they told to do this? What was the sheep to the Mitzrayim? They worshipped the sheep. They worshipped the sheep. By the way, what did the Jewish people do? What did the others all? They were shepherds. Some say they hated the Jews because they had to hit their God, right? Because when you herd sheep, you got to give a sheep over a smack sometimes, over a stick, you know, keep it in line. And some say they revered them for that, but different opinions. Anyway, they took a sheep, bring it to the house. On that day, the Mitzrayim saw this. They got very upset, but there was some miracle that they weren't able to attack the Jewish people. Somehow, something happened. They weren't able to. They were protected on the 10th of Nisan. What did eventually happen to the sheep? What did they do with it? Killed it. Took the blood on the mezuzot. Then they cooked it whole, not in pieces. One big shawarma, right? Not shredded, but one big kebab they put on a spit so that everyone could see it. They couldn't break the bones. They couldn't make me into mincemeat or into borscht, whatever. One whole animal, and then they ate it. They ate their God. That's what they did. They ate their God. This miracle of not being attacked when they brought the sheep into their homes was such a miracle that we remember it even today.
People
we don't remember it.
People now still bring like sheep to their home and like kill them. Some Sephardim do it.
Some Sephardim still bring sheep into the home and recreate the Korban Pesach.
Yeah.
Wow. Could be a problem today. Could be a problem today. Not because you're not allowed to bring a Korban Pesach without the possibly even without the Beit HaMikdash actually. Actually, many Jews settled in Sfat for that reason, so they wouldn't have to be close enough. They would have to bring a korban. How do we celebrate this today?
I don't understand how that's such a miracle, because like it was going on during the plague, so wouldn't they be distracted?
So they could have been. I think this was after, actually. Where is this?
On page 63, like, here. It says, apart from the miraculous display.
Where are you? Top of the page, bottom of the page? Bottom of the page, there was another miracle that occurred just before leaving Egypt. Yeah. God instructed Egypt to take a lamb, which means going to be the God, and slaughter on the night of the plague of the firstborn, as the Midrash relates. So that means if the plague finished that night, when Paro went through, the Mitzrayim was still there. They weren't all dead. They were still there, the Mitzrayim.
Yeah, but like they're probably so distracted that like, oh my God, my kid just died.
You know, it reminds me, it's like the Second World War. They're so distracted, they've got battle everywhere and still able to come and kill the Jews. Right at the last moment. They don't really care, I guess.
Towards the end, where they kill the most.
That's where they kill the most. They got quick to get in as many possible. It could be. It could be. This day is celebrated by a holiday called Shabbat HaGadol. I think the original one was on a Shabbat, but we still celebrate it on Shabbat, even if the Shabbat is not the 10th of Nisan. Okay? In other words, the event happened on the 10th of Nisan, but we don't celebrate the 10th of Nisan, we celebrate it on the Shabbat before, which could be, you know, right before Pesach, or quite a bit before Pesach, more than 4 days. So the Shabbat before Pesach is referred to as Shabbat HaGadol.
Why not Gdola?
What?
Why not Gdola?
Shabbat HaGadola. Shabbat HaGadol. I don't know. Good question. That's referred to it. Look at the Torah, Or HaChaim, page 63. V'atam lefi shenaseh bo nes gadol v'pesach, sheba pesach Mitzrayim, on the Pesach of Mitzrayim. V'chu ba'asor dechtiv, ba'asor l'chodesh hazeh kulachem seh. They were told to take this sheep lebeitz avos, seh lebeis, each house had one. Right? V'pesach sheyatzu Yisrael Mitzrayim, haya b'yom chamishi. We know they left on the Yom Chamishi. Kedita v'seder olam. That's how he demonstrates it. V'nimsa sh'asara v'chodesh yu Shabbat. So actually the 10th of Nisan, what happened to be that year of Shabbat. So we celebrate the Shabbat aspect of it, but not on the actual day itself, because not every year it falls on the same day. We keep it on Shabbat. Right? Before. The Shabbat before Pesach is called Shabbat HaGadol. The real reason for it is a grape, because the Jewish people took their sheep and weren't killed because of it. Okay? However, that day is used throughout communities of the world to prepare for Pesach. They learn halachot. There's always a drashah, the synagogue, the rabbis bring everyone together. There's a lot of halachot they need to review. So that's become the day where everyone goes to shul and like reviews the halachot of the upcoming holiday. What actually happened? Yeah. According to this, that day, Shabbat, before Mitzrayim, before they left Mitzrayim.
What? No, it says right here, they left on Thursday,
so the 10th. So the 10th was the 10th, before, not after, before. The 10th of Nisan. They left on the 15th. Yeah? They left on the
15th.
Oh, okay. You get it? Yeah? Okay. So what actually happened? V'lachu lehem kol achad seh lepischo, k'sharo oto v'kari mitato. They took the sheep, brought it to the house, and they tied it to the foot of the bed. Right? V'shal Mitzrayim, lama zeh lachem? And they said, what's going on over the Mitzrayim? The Mitzrayim was saying to them, v'shivam, v'shchat, they said, we're going to kill it. This was a suicidal move, supposedly. L'shem Pesach, Mitzvah Hashem aleinu, because Hashem gave us this mitzvah. V'ayu, shineim kaot, this expression, their teeth were on edge. They were extremely angry. Hashashochtem es Elokeichem. We're killing their gods. Eloheim, actually, because it's not real gods. V'ayu, Rishayim lomar lehem. They weren't able somehow to do anything. V'yal Shem oso anes korin oto Shabbat HaGadol. It's called Shabbat HaGadol because of that nice. That's what Shabbat HaGadol is all about. Okay? Killing an Egyptian lamb really brought you certain death. Okay? Turnover. So that's two miracles. We have the 10 Makos. We spoke about the Shabbat HaGadol Nes. Let's talk about another one, which was the splitting of the Red Sea, the Yam Suf. This event, by the way, these events were known. They got around. People heard about them. People knew them. But the splitting of the sea was the big one. The splitting of the sea happened 7 days after leaving Mitzrayim. Okay. Now we're going to go back and discuss that meal that they had. Right? They didn't rush out of Egypt until they were ready to go. As soon as they could go, they ran out of Egypt. Bechipazon, we're going to see. Before they rushed out, they were just there. Oh, we need to finish. So we know from the story of Yisro Moshe Rabbeinu's father-in-law, that he converted because he heard about what happened to the Jewish people. This story had got out. And he heard about it. And he was a priest in Midian, neighboring area. However, when he heard about what happened, he said, I'm converting. By the way, they say he was a priest of every single religion in the entire world. There wasn't a god that he hadn't, small g, that he hadn't worshipped. Imagine his life. There wasn't a single god he hadn't worshipped. And he's considered to be really the first convert to Judaism. So the Gemara asks, and Rashi brings this down. It says, "Vayishma Yisro." What did he hear? Shemalba, and Rabbi Yeshua said he heard about the war of Amalek, which itself was a miraculous victory. Rabbi Lezer says, "Matan Torah." Okay. And Rabbi Eliezer says, "No, he heard about Kriyas Yamsuf." Once he heard about Kriyas Yamsuf, how did he hear about it? So according to the Midrash, it wasn't just that water that split. Every water in the world split. There was some shift in the world that every water, wherever you were, split. So everyone knew the Jewish people leaving Mitzrayim. They said, wait, what's going on over here? And that's what they saw. And actually, they say, so why didn't the plagues do this? Have you heard about the plagues, which he had as well? So the Maharal over here, I won't do the whole thing in length, but just so you know about it, the Maharal says that localized miracles was one thing, they had Egypt, but these miracles went everywhere. Okay? And the miracle of Amalek, the sun stopped in the sky, right? Remember that? In order to keep fighting. So these were global events. And global events affect people. So this whole Messias Mitzrayim wasn't just a localized event for the Jewish people that were there. These were international, global miracles that happened to the Jewish people that everyone knew about. This wasn't just a lesson for the Mitzrayim and for the Jewish people who were there, but for everyone. So that connects these miracles. Amalek, Har Sinai, and Yam Suf. Each one of those were known internationally. It was a known thing that this was happening. That's how the Maharal in Gur Arya understands this. Oh, since we're here, let's just finish off. Interesting. You know, we'll finish with this. It's a nice piece on page 66, which is the last piece. This summarizes it very nicely. So we call the Pesach Seder. What's the Pesach Seder? What does the word Seder mean? Order, right? For the word Sidur, which is the order of prayers, the Pesach Seder. But actually, this isn't Seder. There was no Seder. Everything was turned upside down. The entire world lost its Seder. So the Sfas Emes brings down a beautiful thing. And he says that actually, this is the Seder for the Jewish people. The Seder for the Jewish people is the miraculous. We are the people of miracles. So that is our Seder. You would say it should be called the non-Seder, because everything's gone out of order. Right? So he says no. He says the natural order for the Jewish people is the miraculous. Sometimes revealed, sometimes hidden. But that is the Seder of events for the Jewish people. The natural order for the Jewish people, for the Klal Yisrael, for the Jewish people through history, is the miraculous and not being held down by the natural order. And actually, that explains why the miracles, there's no miracles happen to the Avot that you see in the Torah. Right? There's no miracles that you see in the Torah that happen to the Avot, to the forefathers. Okay, there's stories, the Midrash, we know Nimrod took Avraham Avinu, Prince Kiftshon, but that's not in the Torah. So we begin to see, with the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yud with the Hey, with the Vav with the Hey, the beginning of the miraculous order for the Jewish people. It came to us as a nation. It's not individuals, it's in the koach of the entire nation that miracles happen to us. Which is why you don't see miracles up to this point in the Torah, right? It starts at this point and continues through Jewish history. It's not one person who's able to fool people, as it were, and to show that he's a miracle. It happens en masse. So this event is the birth of the Jewish people, leaving Mitzrayim, and these miracles come to not just a way of hurting other people or punishing them, which is that as well, it's also there as a demonstration to us. That's the understanding of Seder. Any questions, thoughts, comments? All right. We will continue, God willing, on Monday, and we'll start to look at the idea of nationhood in more detail. And then we're going to run through the Seder itself, the different things we do, and the halachot of it all. Oh, we have so much to do! Woo! Baruch Hashem, that's right. Okay, have a great day.